Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com. Upwork.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The ever-evolving case against Brian Koberger. We're going to get into it today. The defense is laser-focused, if you've noticed the headlines in the last week or two, on 2 pieces of evidence that they hope will create reasonable doubt. Unidentified male DNA at the crime scene and the potential weaknesses in how investigators obtained their forensic evidence. Are they anything, or are they big nothing burgers? Pardon the pun to Koberger, as his attorneys argue that the presence of DNA from 2 identified men raises questions about whether law enforcement prematurely locked in on their client while ignoring other potential suspects. But does that argument really actually hold a lot of weight, or is it just kind of the classic defense strategy to muddy the waters, which we all know Ann Taylor is very good at? To help us break it all down, we're joined by retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, an expert in the area of criminal investigations and forensic analysis. Jennifer, when we're talking about investigators finding unidentified DNA at a crime scene, how big of a deal is it? I suppose it all depends on where it was found and all that, but how do they determine whether it's relevant to the case or just incidental? And in your experience, how often do defense teams unsuccessfully use that kind of evidence to challenge a prosecution's case?
Well, when you look at this particular case, so you have to really focus on all the factors surrounding this DNA.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, the DNA that's found on the inside, first of all, identifying, is this blood DNA? Is this touch DNA? Is this hair? Is this semen? What is this? In this case, I believe they said it is blood DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, that is could be significant, but you have to consider what kind of a house this was.
Yes.
This was a house where dozens and dozens of individuals were often partying, having a good time, and people were in that home that the renters, the deceased, unfortunately, didn't even know. Mm-hmm. We've seen the film footage. You know, where are the people who rent this house? Oh, they're not even here.
Yeah.
And that's just one party example. So you have to really take everything in context in terms of the amount of people in and out of the home. If you had a home with two elderly people, no one ever came in, no one ever came out, and then you had that blood, it could be more significant. But remember, DNA can last for quite a long period of time on any given object in the form of blood. Mm-hmm. And so from that regard, you can't make any particular leaps. And this, in my opinion, completely waters down the blood DNA that they're citing. One example of unidentified on that banister, by the way.
Yes. When I heard this, I mean, I know there's a lot of headlines out there about it. I know some of our headlines that are out there about it that make you go, what's this? And then you read about it, you watch it, and you go, oh, okay, I get it better. But my initial thought was, it's a party house. And it's what these two other examples were found in areas you're probably going to find blood DNA, or at least touch DNA, a handrail, and a glove outside. I cook all the time, so I'm lucky today. I didn't cook this week, so my hands are cut free. But on a week where I'm normally cooking, there's usually at least something where on a handrail, in a glove, I'm sure you'd find my blood DNA there, at least a trace of it. So a hand railing isn't that shocking. It wasn't near the bodies like the touch DNA was on the knife sheath. And when we're talking about the outside, I challenge anyone in a northern state where it's cold out, especially a college town. I've lived in several. And you go out for a walk in winter at night or any time of the day, really, you will find probably within 15 minutes, 2 to 3 gloves laying out somewhere that somebody dropped, whether it's in the road, on the sidewalk, in somebody's lawn. And again, if you're wearing gloves and you live your life in any way, shape, or form, you're likely going to find that person's DNA in that blood, I would think.
Well, yeah, all good points, Tony. And let's take it one step beyond that with the glove. That glove was found well after the crime. Mm-hmm. It was found by a YouTube creator. Mm-hmm. It was found on the cartilage. It wasn't as if it was up into the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And I completely believe that had been searched and this was left after. It was really found out there in and around where the trash cans would be. And again, well after. So this doesn't surprise me at all, as you said, with all the people passing by that house, dozens and dozens of people, just to look, that somebody wouldn't have dropped a glove. And no, I don't believe it was missed by the initial crime scene mm-hmm. individuals. I've looked at so many pictures of that area trying to see, you know, any sign of that glove being there around the 13th, and it just wasn't.
Yeah.
So for people to make the leap that because a glove was found there well after the date of the event is just, it's a big leap.
It is a leap. I mean, it makes for a great headline if you're a YouTuber or something and you're trying to find something. But again, does it really mean anything at all, especially if it's very likely left after the fact? And yes, great point. It was a place of gawking for a little while there, and a place that people were also going and lighting candles and paying tribute and trying to make some peace and say goodbye to their friends. So there was a lot of people coming and going from that very specific location. One of the points that Ann Taylor is making in her arguments here is, well, why was these two pieces of blood DNA not in the report? Can you answer that?
Well, first of all, I always say whenever you hear something in court and whenever it's espoused by a lawyer, take a minute and sure. and think about exact context and what their drive is. So we unfortunately are not able to see much of this information she's mm-hmm. referring to. Because so much is under seal. Mm-hmm. So I would say I don't know if that's accurate or not. I mean, I take a very critical eye when it comes to attorneys saying things like this, mm-hmm. Because they're saying it from the vantage point and, you know, that they want to draw. In addition, what I found shocking is there's not much more DNA that hasn't been identified. Very early on in the case, I mentioned that imagine how much time it is going to take for all the known individuals that would have been in that house, all the fraternity, sorority, mm-hmm. anybody that Dylan and, you know, the surviving roommate and Bethany could tell them about that was in and out of that house. Imagine all the DNA swabs that went on.
Yeah.
Imagine how much DNA has been found in that house, but it's been identified.
It's clear. Yeah.
Yeah. It's clear who it belonged to because they've swabbed all these people that were in and out. And so I'm surprised they didn't come back and say there's 15. So they did probably, I would believe, a remarkable job getting samples to, you know, to compare to, and there still may be more samples, and they may actually at some point be able to identify it. But again, party house, difficult to do.
Yeah.
And I take a lot of issue with how she phrased that.
Yeah.
It's Tony, I'm going to give you another example. Do you remember when a document came out and she said, no DNA found in the car, in the office, or in his apartment. Mm-hmm. But you notice she never mentioned 1122 King Road, which
True.
I always found glaring. So mm-hmm. by omission, did she not mention that because they found his DNA in other parts at that house there? And so, in other words, I don't know the report she's referring to, but I would need to see that report to comment.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to break down the questions that I'm seeing a lot of people asking this week about this, whether I know the answers or not. The other thing that I see a lot of people asking is, okay, no match, but was this, I believe it was put into CODIS. I could be wrong. Was it put into CODIS? And was it, did they look in the ancestral one as well, just to give it a shot to see where that could possibly go, like they did with Koberger?
Okay. Two answers for that. First of all, 100% they ran it through CODIS. That's just 101. You know, mm-hmm. when you get a fingerprint, you run it through APHIS. When you get DNA, you run it through CODIS. Number two, do I believe they compared it against multiple DNA samples of others that were known to be in that house? Yes. Would they go through genetic genealogy? I don't believe so. First of all, it's extremely expensive, mm-hmm. extremely time involved, and you know, I think their explanation is going to be what we've surmised, and that is you have one blood DNA sample on a railing at a party house. Not, in my opinion, it's not at the crime scene, it's not on one of the victims, it's not on the bed, it's not on the knife sheath, it's not in and around, it's on a railing that
yeah.
people would hold. If you have a hangnail,
yes,
blood could get there.
Yeah,
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So I think that it probably ended there. Although, because they may be getting concerned about this becoming a huge issue, they may go that route.
They got to do what they got to do. I get it. She is the defense attorney, and she's doing a good job at it, trying to at least put reasonable doubt out there into the public. The other thing that's been brought up, and I do know the answer to this, but maybe you can give us a little better insight on it. Blood DNA versus touch DNA. Now, on the surface, if you know nothing about DNA, it sounds like, well, one must be a lot stronger than the other. They both can lead in very pretty much absolute directions, can they not?
Absolutely. There's blood, semen, hair, sweat, touch, which I hate to even call it touch. It's literally your skin cells mm-hmm. that you rub off. In this case, it makes all the sense in the world because that button snap is so difficult to open on a K-bar knife sheath for mm-hmm. obvious reasons. And so you're literally scraping those dead cells on your thumb/finger that would be removed and be there. Makes all the sense in the world. But DNA is DNA, meaning once it's been evaluated, it is still DNA and positively can be, and I don't want to say matched, because how DNA works is it's excluded from being anyone else. Mm-hmm. In this case, in the 8 trillions or something,
yeah,
some number, or octillion, sorry.
It's high,
a number,
yeah,
that none of us had ever seen, because there's not that many people on the planet.
Yeah.
So it's basically so excluded that it's him. Mm-hmm. And that's how DNA works, and it is DNA.
Yes, I can. And if anybody wants to know more about that, I did an hour the other week with Dan Crane, who is very much part of the world of DNA and genealogy and the science behind all that. Very interesting talk, who goes into super detail on why they both are completely full of merit, but how. Then we get into the questions, the other point that the defense is making of, ethically, what did the FBI act appropriately, or did the investigators act appropriately when going into the genetic genealogy database? From what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Robin Drake who explained this to me, was the fact that it's against policy to go into that database, but it's not illegal. It's not against the law, but it would violate an internal type policy for that to have been done, which it was done, but it clearly obviously led us to a specific individual. Is that accurate? How do you view all of that?
How I view all of that is it comes down to warrants.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to warrants, number one, and I loved how Judge Hippler addressed this. You know, so let me understand this, Ann Taylor. Are you trying to say that somehow there's a right to privacy of Brian Koberger and his DNA wasn't even in the database? I just love that. I mean, generally, you know, I'm absolutely paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But that's the point, is, you know, the people that are in that database have some sense of protection, but certainly not from warrants. Mm-hmm. And they sign away really their rights to be protected in certain disclosures when they submit their DNA for testing. So as far as FBI policy, my understanding is search warrants. You have to be backed by a judge.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that was not how that was handled.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to that entire hearing and it was long.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the confusing point to me. So you're saying your client had a right to privacy. Oh, his DNA wasn't in it.
It's a lot of word salad that Ann Taylor has been using the last week when talking about all of this. Another point that was brought up earlier in the week, Howard Blum had actually made it with Megyn Kelly. He fully believes that Koberger is behind these alleged crimes, but he had brought up the idea of, was it possibly planted? And I've heard the planting argument now on both sides in different ways. What's your thoughts on that, of the idea that Koberger was so ahead of the game when he was so not ahead of the game in other areas, a la I like to look at stars as my alibi, that he had the foresight to go in and put someone else's DNA on a handrail and in a glove outside, or it was the other quote-unquote killer or killers that were trying to throw people off? Or is that just really kind of a, you know, we're getting into ABC miniseries a la 1988 at this point with this kind of an idea?
I find it all so ridiculous. It's Occam's razor. Again, that glove was found well after. It's a party house. No, he didn't go in there and plant any of this. He made a colossal mistake. A colossal mistake was not securing that sheath, Tony. Mm-hmm. And that is why we're here today, and that's why he's sitting in a cell. I truly believe that but for that knife sheath, this would have taken much longer to solve. And because that's really the smoking gun in this, and that's why they're focused on that, meaning Ann Taylor.
Yeah, I mean, and the I know that that's her big thing. She's trying to get that out of court. That's her job to do it. Do you think she has a chance in hell on that happening?
No, I really don't. And I say that only because of listening to Judge Hippler's responses to her. Mm-hmm. And it's clear to me that he believes from a legal perspective under Idaho law that it was collected legally. It was abandoned, if you will. He compared it to fingerprints, as I recall. And he said, listen, you leave a fingerprint at a crime scene and you think that that has some privacy right not to be run through a database? Again, paraphrasing, you guys can go back and listen to all the footage. But my point is he makes a perfect point. If you leave your DNA at a crime scene, you have no privacy right with that. Mm-hmm. And that is really when you dumb all of the word salad down and you look at the law compared to what happened, this is really how simple it is.
Yeah. It seems Ann Taylor is trying to equate equality. Does that make, I think it makes sense in what I'm trying to say. Equate equality to the handrail and the glove to a knife sheath that's literally under the body. And the knife sheath being the murder weapon or being, you know, connected to the murder weapon. And she's trying to say, well, they're both one and the same because they both existed in that house. That would also mean that pretty much every piece of DNA in that house is completely equal under her kind of word salad of speaking this week and trying to water this down.
Yeah, no. And again, you know, kudos to the collection being done.
Oh, yeah.
They collected that blood. I mean, it shows their thoroughness. And like I said, I guarantee there's so much other DNA that we're not even discussing in that house that was compared to other individuals and a positive male match was found. And they haven't found the male, what I would believe was a party goer. They haven't been able to ID him yet. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, if I were on this case, and specifically because I think we're far out from trial, I probably would go through the money and time to do genetic genealogy just to, you know, thwart all of this speculation. I also wonder if they got DNA from the individual on YouTube that discovered the glove.
That'd be interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's, because obviously that would be, did that YouTuber like pick up the glove? Did they do anything with the glove? Did they go, hey, investigators, come here, look at this?
No, they were careful with it.
Okay.
This was a former police officer.
Okay.
So he was careful. But again, as you and I have pointed out, you know, you can have a little nick on your hand and you know, have issues happen with discarding your DNA someplace you don't know you discarded it. And who knows who else might have touched it. I always thought it was possibly a garbage man's glove only because of how the glove looks.
Yeah.
This isn't a sleek nitrile glove that, you know, one might wear to commit a crime so your fingerprints aren't left behind. This was a bulky glove.
Yeah, like a worker type glove. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it looked like to me. So nothing like what was believed to be worn by the perpetrator of this crime or like the gloves that were found pursuant to the search warrant in Brian Koberger's possession. So this wasn't that. But I don't think anybody's trying to argue that it's Brian Koberger's. They're trying to argue that it would be the real killer's glove. Yeah. But again, it's the timing is just off.
Watch, it turns out to be OJ's.
Oh, gosh.
Not to make a horrible joke about this whole thing. Oh. Is this going to be, I mean, let's play the cards out and let's pretend that Koberger is convicted and found guilty. Is this going to be like appellate issue number one for Ann Taylor?
Well, you know, I think the prosecution so far has done such a good job of alleviating a lot of appellate issues. He's been, meaning Koberger, has been treated with complete kid gloves. Mm-hmm. The Bureau, as I said a long time ago, the Bureau handled the bulk of this whole case that we're now seeing. You know, you had police officers with their names on different documents, but the real investigation piece was really being done by the Bureau. And we have such a strict paperwork and policy that is well inside of what any law requires, which mm-hmm. I think is what former Special Agent Drake was trying to say, to prevent any legal issues. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is going to prove to be a huge positive for the prosecution in terms of appellate problems down the road. Mm-hmm. I just don't see any. Will they try to argue? They may, but I don't see what the appellate issue would be in terms of, you know, Sixth Amendment rights or, you know, other right that would have been violated.
I know it's going to go anywhere, but I'm just trying to think down the road, what are they going to look at in here and go, well, this may be, you know, just trying to, again, throw something at the wall, which inevitably, if he's found guilty, they certainly will. Let's talk about the mental health records that have been turned over to the defense this last week. What does this mean? What are they going to be trying to glean off of these records? Been turned over to the prosecution, rather, from the defense. All right. What is the prosecution going to be looking for in this to use to their advantage?
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up because, you know, so much is sealed in terms of what was even produced to who, when, what. And now Judge Hippler is saying, listen, we're going to let it out what has been produced, not the records mm-hmm. themselves to the public, but we're going, as a public, we get to see now what they have. And it was not only records regarding Brian Koberger, recall, it was records regarding his family, mm-hmm. which I found also interesting. I think it'll be interesting to thwart, again, in Idaho, you can't use mental health to fight a conviction, but you can when it comes to sentencing. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered if the records, because we know a lot of his mental health, his visual snow, and other issues that he had perennially growing up throughout his life. We know a lot about that because what he made available on social media. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to be able to see what treatments he had. And I think this could be helpful down the road when it comes to sentencing. But could the prosecution use this to actually show sort of the mental instability of Brian Koberger from the standpoint of the self-loathing mm-hmm. and that the how terrible he felt about himself, which of course lends itself to motive.
Yeah,
you know, somebody who would commit a crime like this out of anger and self-loathing and retribution for what they see anyway is their life not being what they wished it would have been.
Almost where it's kind of a double-edged sword when you look at it from how the prosecution can use it, where they can, yes, totally use it to lend itself to the self-loathing and the motive. And like, look, this, if you're to figure out a character of someone who may be capable of committing a crime like this, or has walked right up to the line of doing it or did do it, that may very much help them in their case on personality. But it may also save his life at the same time, where the jury may go, okay, this guy had some serious mental health problems. Let's just lock him away. Let's not kill him. But you can't do one without the other if you're the prosecution.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And, you know, it begs the question, though, would a jury want him to be put to death? They've sought the death penalty. Mm-hmm. It's been approved from a legal standpoint. He's facing the death penalty. But that doesn't mean he's going to get the death penalty. And I certainly see Ann Taylor down the road, if he's convicted, using these records to make a sympathy plea on his behalf. And then I see the prosecution likely saying, I don't care how much trauma and turmoil you've had within yourself. Again, this is a guy that was raised in a nice area. He was raised by, I believe his mother was an educator.
Mm-hmm.
To our knowledge, we don't know anything about some horrible life.
No.
From the standpoint of how he was treated or that he was abused. There's been nothing that's come out about that. It's more of his issues with himself. And so I could also see jurors saying, you know what, Maddie, Zanna, Ethan, Kaylee, they had no chance.
Yeah. And one thing that jurors are not typically the greatest at is understanding mental health, and where there may not be that empathy there for him at that point. Obviously, environment, yes, of course, that plays a big role, but not always. Sometimes, you know, you have the perfect upbringing, you have everything's good, parents are good, there's not abuse, there's not this, there's not that. It still doesn't always prevent a broken brain. And if I know I'm just being very, very vague in that statement, the big medical term of broken brain, which we hear all the time in the medical field. But if someone does essentially have something wrong with them, I know it's just kind of a catch-all, but if someone does have something that's not firing right, that is really beyond their capabilities of dealing with, again, that does not make any sort of excuse for murder or anything of that nature, but it does kind of give you an idea more on the recipe of if this person has been suffering from something for quite some time, and maybe they get a little bit of grace and don't get put to death. But I don't know. I mean, we've seen jurors put people to death with a lot of evidence of a very broken brain before.
Well, the biggest point that I got from his writings was he had no empathy for anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that is at the very core, at least in my belief, of why serial killers become serial killers. I'm not saying he's a serial killer. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying why mass murders are committed, why school shootings are committed. They have no ability to empathize mm-hmm. with what's going to happen when they put the gun to somebody's head.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, the brain blows up and then they go on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they lost that ability. That was my biggest takeaway. Not that he has some big mental crisis,
mm-hmm.
but rather he just doesn't empathize.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens in this vein.
It is. And it'll be interesting how much that is argued and what they get into, because then you're not talking mental illness. You're talking a personality disorder of some sort. Then you get into psychopath and all those other things, which some people are just born in that way. But again, doesn't necessarily then preclude you from being executed by the government if you go on a killing spree. And in this case, if I were a parent in this matter, and I know everybody has different opinions about the death penalty, and not that my opinion really matters at all, but even that being said, if he does have that, I would still be like, take him out, please. Like, what's the purpose? It's like putting an animal down that's very damaged and is going to keep biting and killing people or hurting people in some way, shape, or form. Why not? That's my personal opinion on it. But I guess a jury will ultimately have to make the decision on that.
Yeah, and it's a big one. But this is a case, if any case came forward with, I think, a jury empathizing with these victims, and once they show the bloody crime scene and really what these victims suffered,
mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be, really impactful to this jury when it comes to making this decision.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists, all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after
after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.